Do you live for Sunday dinner and that slow-cooked all-day flavor of a pot roast that falls apart with a dull spoon? Thanks to Omaha Steaks, I'm never shy about the proteins when it comes to Sunday dinners at our house. Every steak is aged to perfection to maximize tenderness and hand-cut by master butchers in America's heartland. Get 50% off the world's best everyday protein. Go to omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their semi-annual sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's 50% off at omahasteaks.com and an extra $35 off with promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to https://omahasteaks.com to get 50% off site-wide during their semi-annual sale. And use promo code YUM at checkout for an extra $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Cachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor, crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to cachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.
Well, you can see right now there's probably between 2 and 2.5 million people out on the streets since 8 a.m. this morning. Total show of national solidarity by the people. And you will not see this, not even a second of it will be covered on Western mainstream media. You won't hear about it on any of the U.S. media.
So that right there is my guest for today's show, Patrick Henningsen, returning to the show from 21st Century Wire. Patrick, welcome. That was you just, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago in the streets of Tehran, and how so much has changed in the past few weeks. So I was wondering if we could start off on today's show just talking about your trip to Iran and what you saw there. And I think maybe most importantly is, you know, your a white Western guy, and we're hearing all over the media that essentially the Iranians want to kill all of us. So were you safe in Tehran when you were out there in the streets with 2 to 2.5 million Iranians? I mean, certainly if there are a lot of dangerous Shia, Islamist fundamentalists that just want to kill white Westerners, you would have been a prime target. So were you safe and welcomed in Tehran, or were you rejected as a Westerner?
Thank you for inviting me on the show today, Kyle. Yeah, I actually had my American passport in my pocket, you know, so I'm a white American male in Tehran, and I felt absolutely not only safe, felt very much at home in many ways, just because the vibrancy in terms of the political discourse in Iran and in Tehran specifically, it's very, very vibrant. And there, you know, the political discussions are very high level. Iranians in general follow U.S. politics very closely. They know, Democrats, Republicans. They know who all the mavericks are in our Congress and so forth. They follow Trump. They follow Trump his whole career. They know the whole, you know, story arc of Donald Trump and U.S. politics, U.S. history, and everything else. So it is a great place to be in that respect. The Iranians, I was out, what you saw there, that clip you ran, I literally came out of the airport, cleared customs. They finally let us go, got our final stamps, and we got onto a bus. I was with a number of other journalists as well, some from the West, some from Europe as well, and the Middle East, and went to, and it was the national day that day when we arrived. So we made our way to central Tehran, And there was so much traffic coming into the city of people going to this event that they people literally parked their car on the major artery that enters into the city from the same that comes from the airport, the international airport. And when we finally got to the main thoroughfare, which connects two of the main largest sort of squares in the capital city, and the people are demonstrating and marching between those two major squares, it was absolutely incredible. And what I saw was, it's kind of a festival atmosphere. So this is their equivalent of their Independence Day, marking the anniversary of the revolution. And it is a kind of a festival atmosphere. They're trolling. They have these sort of theatrical performances where they burned the statue of Bao in effigy and said, as a reaction to the Epstein files, kind of, I mean, and the cheer, standing around cheering as they're torching this giant replica of Bao. I mean, it's like, it's the type of thing you'd see it, like, you know, in this terms of its scale, like a major U.S. sporting event or a Super Bowl parade or something like that. And they're that's how they do their politics. And so, I mean, it's fascinating. They also had the drones and the missiles out on display, doing, you know, laps around the main square. And so we got a chance to go up close and see some of those things in a kind of public setting. And I literally ran into people that recognized me amongst the 2 million people and had great conversations. And that clip that you have, a blogger asked to film me on her phone, that ended up getting picked up by the major national media and press TV, and it went kind of global at that point. And I received such a backlash for this video. But I hadn't, what you saw there, I hadn't slept in 48 hours. And it was a difficult journey. You know, right before I got clearance for press accreditation through the embassy, the U.S. State Department issued a very stern warning saying, if you're American, get out or don't go. And if you can't leave, shelter in place and get food and water and hide, basically. That's what the U.S. virtual embassy in Iran, it's a website, that's what they said, literally what they said. And when I saw that, and that was like about 6 days before I left, I thought, wow, I really have to go. So the trip wasn't confirmed until 24 hours before I flew. And I had to be in position on standby to be able to be eligible for it. So, but when I saw that State Department warning, I was like, I have to go because I might not have an opportunity to go. And I was cognizant that I could get stuck there because the naval assets had already been amassed circling the Persian Gulf. And if they struck the airport, then there's no really way out other than by land or having to go to a remote airport or to Pakistan or something like that. So an arduous journey nonetheless. So yeah. You are taking a risk there. But I was happy to do that. And I'm glad I was able to go. They only gave us a short visa because of the security situation.
Right.
And that, obviously they don't want anything to happen to any foreign journalists. That's, you know, top priority for their Ministry of Information, but I was allowed to meet and see and go out pretty much on my own. I didn't want to go out on my own all the time because I have a translator because I don't speak Farsi, so it helps to have a translator. But and I made such good friends and some of my colleagues and cohort. Journalistic cohort as well. And, you know, the other thing I'm going to say is I went out at night and to the busiest marketplace in Tehran, in northern Tehran, and half the women were uncovered. Literally thousands of women and half were uncovered. So this lie that spreads around America that if a woman shows her hair that she'll be beaten and arrested by the quote regime is complete fabrication. It doesn't happen. And we also met with the police and saw the evidence of the riots and the foreign agent provocateurs and that whole situation that was that incendiary element that was injected into the country by U.S. and Israeli intelligence. And what happened was terrible for the police. Hundreds of police were killed. Many were burned alive. We saw the unredacted evidence of that. The redacted evidence, of course, was much of it was broadcast on Iranian national TV, but you didn't see any of that syndicated in the Western media. And so there's plenty. I mean, so I can say categorically that the narrative that Iran massacred thousands of its own people and these peaceful democratic protesters is a total fiction, a complete fabrication, categorically. I have no doubt in my mind, and I saw plenty of evidence to that effect, as well as reams of burned buses, burned fire trucks, EMS responder vehicles that were set on fire, aside from the police that were burned alive. People were shot, beaten. So there was a real agenda there to foment instability and unrest. And then the President Trump, then taking to the airwaves saying, this is your moment, rise up and take over your institutions. It's obvious that was incitement. So for anyone to say that that wasn't a classic color revolution formula, exactly as we saw in Maidan in February 2014, exactly as we saw in Homs in Syria in 2011 and in 2012, and also in Libya and Serbia, Yugoslavia, the list goes on, Eastern Europe, Belarus. We've seen this playbook over and over, and that's what happened here clearly, but it was done on a level with resourcing that is quite breathtaking in terms of what was spent on the media propaganda campaigns in the West in January, and what was spent in terms of Starlink terminals that were smuggled into the country. We also saw evidence of narcotics that were being distributed. So, and I saw that in Syria, by the way, and that I was really interested in that point, because how do you get people to act just completely insane and violent? We also saw this with ISIS elements as well. Mm-hmm. And the police there believed there were amphetamines and other similar types of drugs and spice, something called spice. These types of drugs were also distributed and injected into that. So there's a lot of disaffected youth, obviously, that got swept up in the mob violence with very skilled and well-trained people in the back lines shooting police officers from within the crowd, using the crowd as human shields. And that's when things spun out of control very quickly, and we saw that sort of period of about 7 days of violence and instability, which the U.S. and Israel hoped to capitalize on, but didn't after the Iranians shut off the internet and also intercepted a lot of the Starlink transmissions, were able to track the location of some of the terminals, and quickly were able to shut down the organizational, I think, element. That's the impression I got from the police chiefs that we met in the main municipality of Tehran, and the visual evidence that we saw as well. So I can. Why is this important, Kyle? Because this narrative of the regime or the mullahs massacring their own people, that's the actual backstop for manufacturing consent for this war, because the nuclear conversation has fallen flat on its face. It's so threadbare and thin that it's not a serious argument. But what happens with people like, let's say, a right-wing populist or a left-wing anti-war activist, this is what happened with Iraq and also with Libya and Syria, et cetera. They'll say, look, I oppose the war, but it's better that this evil dictator is out. The world's a safer place without Saddam, without Slobodan Milosevic, without Gaddafi, without Assad, and without Saddam. The list, you can fill in the blanks. That's the general, in terms of the psychological warfare, the information war, that is so important to establish that backdrop in the West, because that's how you get just background consent for this, even though, so they really don't have to give a specific reason for it. There's not going to be a massive public upheaval against this war in the West, because the average sort of moderate or even anti-war moderate will say, it's okay, because this is a very evil regime. Even John Stewart was, who is against Trump and against the war, was railing on his show this week, calling the supreme leader an evil dictator, almost insinuating that he deserved to die. So John Stewart bought into the fake propaganda of the 30,000 massacred by the regime or whatever. And that's, so in a way, John Stewart, who's anti-war as it gets in mainstream, he is buttressing the war narrative for manufacturing consent, which, you know, is extraordinary.
Yeah, it truly is. Now, I want to get into the start of this conflict. This is President Donald Trump on March 3rd discussing and explaining We Attack First.
But I thought we were going to have a situation where we were going to be attacked. They were getting ready to attack Israel. They were getting ready to attack others. You're seeing that right now. And a lot of those missiles that are hitting in, those are stationary. Those were aimed there for a long period of time at these other countries. So I think I was right about that. We attacked first. And if we didn't, it could have been, you know, look, we're really decimating them. They're being decimated.
Do you feel too full after meals like your digestion could use a little support? Try Bitterex from Quiksilver Scientific. Bitterex is a blend of botanical bitter extracts designed to support healthy digestion and your body's natural digestive processes. Bitter herbs have been used for centuries to support digestive function, helping stimulate digestive activity. Just a few pumps before meals make Quiksilver Scientific's Bitterex easy to add to your routine. Get 10% off and free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast for 10% off and free shipping. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
So, Patrick, I'm wondering, you know, we've heard Donald Trump say this. We've heard Marco Rubio say the Israelis were going to attack first, and then they were going to strike a American bases. So we had to attack Iran first to defend ourselves because Israel was going to attack. I'm just wondering how much of a role influence did Israel have on Trump's decision to go to war with Iran?
Well, in a way, Trump is basically saying the quiet part out loud, as Marco Rubio has. If you can look at it that way, you can say that based on the statements by Trump there and Rubio, is that the U.S. has no agency whatsoever if Israel decides to start a war, that the U.S. is just automatically compelled. They can't say anything to stop them, and instead they must join them join them in a preemptive strike. Because it's inevitable that there'll be retaliation. Therefore, they must. I mean, it's a crazy kind of counterintuitive argument that certainly defies all logic. But it says something. An essential truth is said there, which is that the U.S. is. You know, I have to ask the fundamental question: is the U.S. the superpower, or is Israel the superpower? Because if Israel's dictating United States decision-making and whether they're going to start a major war that could careen into a regional or even a world war, then they must be, well, a superpower would have the veto power to stop a lesser power from engaging in something like that that could be destabilizing and might work against the United States in the long run. So it appears by the statements of this administration that they have revealed an essential truth about our relationship with the state of Israel, and particularly this administration. This administration being probably the most heavily penetrated, of Israeli, pro-Israeli lobby selected operatives. I mean, look at the two chief negotiators. They're not even official. They don't have official portfolio with the State Department, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. They are Israeli loyalists. They're attending Israeli fundraising events during high-level negotiations, which is unheard of. And so they're reporting directly, in certain way, directly to Netanyahu's office, because, and this is the fundamental constitutional crisis which I see underneath all this, is that Donald Trump did not, the White House did not consult Congress beforehand, but Israel was able to consult its security committee about U.S. operations, because this idea that the U.S. and Israel are separate is something that people need to get over. They're absolutely integrated on the military level. They have a joint command center for the war in Gaza, U.S. Pentagon commanders working with the IDF. It's a joint command center. And they have the same joint operations with regards to Iran. So we're in a situation where Netanyahu could brief his parliament and key members of his parliament about U.S.-Israeli operations that were coming in Iran. And Donald Trump cannot brief or talk to our Congress about the exact same operations. So this is, to me, a constitutional crisis of the highest order, because it really calls into question some really fundamental aspects of our government. And there's no bigger issue than taking your country to war.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, yesterday the Senate voted down the War Powers Resolution. I think as we're on live here, the House just voted, and they also voted down the War Powers Resolution. And that would have constrained the president. But at the same time, there's no actual active authorization for him to go to war. So this, you know, as you mentioned there, this is a real constitutional crisis, where at least with the Iraq war, you know, there was this like build up and an authorization for use of military force, where this time there really was no massive propaganda effort. There was some, but nobody really believed it. And Congress has just kind of passively allowed this to happen. I mean, it's really unbelievable to watch this unfold.
Well, what's more unbelievable is, and the way this vote turned out this week, Kyle, if that vote happened before the war, be a very different result, because there is a general thinking in Washington that once a war is underway, that you don't want to sort of intervene because it could hurt our chances of winning. That's very a natural, logical reaction of a Washington lawmaker or politician. So, but this was available. This vote could have happened before. This could have happened last week, but key Senate Democrats also intervened, including and specifically Chuck Schumer, a New York Democratic senator, who basically said, "Oh yes, we want to vote on this, but not now. Let's do it next week." He knew full well what was coming on Friday. He knew full well, and everyone else did in Washington as well. So the fact that they prevented that vote from happening last week, when it would have, it had a better chance of passing, even by a nose hair, it had a better chance of passing, and might well have done if it caught the political inertia. But we'll never know, will we? Because it was basically, they slow walked it. And that was done by design. And I'm sure, I'm absolutely positive, if you looked at communications with Chuck Schumer and the Israeli lobby or his IPAC handler or whatever, we would, if there was an impeachment or a major congressional inquiry on this, we would definitely learn a lot from the communications between lobbyists and our elected representatives on this. This war could have been stopped before it started if there was political will there. And clearly there isn't, or there wasn't.
So while we're on the topic of Congress, I have this clip from Senator Tom Cotton. Chris, can we play SOT number two?
Brian, no, not at all. I thought Secretaries Rubio and Hegseth, Chairman Kaine, and Director Ratcliffe did a very good job of laying out the intelligence and the current state of operations. The simple reality is Iran has a vast missile arsenal that far exceeds the combined missile defenses of the United States, our Arab friends, and Israel. And it gets much worse every single month. That is an unacceptable risk for the United States. It's an existential risk for our Arab friends in Israel. And it wouldn't get better if we waited for 6 or 12 or 18 months to find a more imminent risk. Mm-hmm. In fact, Iran has posed an imminent risk to the United States for 47 years as they've maimed and killed thousands of Americans without that vast missile arsenal. The president was right to act when he did.
So, Patrick, can there be a 47-year imminent threat? Does that make sense to you? I mean, this war propaganda just seems absolutely pathetic.
No, it's hyperbolic. Tom Cotton is really just a hot air machine for the military-industrial complex and for the neocons, for the Israeli lobby. I mean, I could just pull it. I mean, the whole point, he's saying we've seen the intelligence. That conversation of we've seen the intelligence used to always mean we've seen the intelligence of weapons of mass destruction. Or we've seen, you know, you have to give the Bush administration some credit. And Dick Cheney, at least they respected the public enough to go through the vaudeville act of faking the intelligence and turning into a giant dramatic theatrical piece, which lasted for, you know, a few years to build up to that point. This administration has such utter contempt for the public that they don't care. So they just say make up a reason to attack. So he's saying he's seen the intelligence of the missile program, but weren't they just in high level negotiations with the Iranians? If it was about stabilizing and keeping the region safe, keeping the Persian Gulf safe, keeping our Gulf allies safe, then wouldn't you have pursued a political settlement that would then lead to de-escalation? I mean, wouldn't that be better for everybody? We wouldn't see any of these missiles flying and hitting Tel Aviv or any of these U.S. bases in the region. But the United States did not do that. In fact, the evidence suggests that they never intended to do anything with those negotiations, that was a facade, a deception, in order to buy time to prepare for a sneak attack. And this has happened once. It's happened in June previously as well. It happened during the negotiations with Hezbollah and the assassination of Nasrallah. It happened with the Hamas negotiations and Israel's attack on Hamas negotiators in Doha. This happened with the assassination of Qasem Soleimani under Donald Trump, luring him to Baghdad for peace negotiations, only to be assassinated. This happened twice with Russia and Ukraine during high-level negotiations. I see so this is a clear Israeli tactic which has been adopted by the United States. So this government, in its rhetoric, in its tactics, in its policies, in its methods, is synonymous now with the state of Israel. I find this to be highly problematic, because why would a superpower with the scale, the capabilities of the United States of America have to lower itself into the gutter to do the types of things Israel does, which it calls statecraft, in its effort to, quote, defend itself, which usually entails attacking all of its neighbors and mounting decapitation strikes against anybody that it doesn't like, quite frankly.
While we're right here, what do you make of the U.S. tactics in this war? I mean, you mentioned, you know, the attack happens as the negotiations are going on. In fact, I read today a senior Israeli defense official told Walla, which is an Israeli outlet, that the first mistake the Iranians made was engaging in negotiations. We saw the sinking of an unarmed Iranian ship in international waters that was only there for training exercises, sunk by a U.S. submarine, just, you know, kind of completely defenseless. The bombing of the girls' school, which I read in the New York Times, looks like it was a U.S. attack. I mean, if one of the big propaganda talking points they had before this war was the Iranian government is bad because it kills its people, I mean, what the U.S. and Israel are doing to Iran is far worse than what their own government did. So how could they possibly make that argument? Why are the U.S. tactics so cruel when, as you kind of mentioned, we are the major superpower? We shouldn't have to stoop to that level.
Exactly. If it was all about protecting innocent Iranians, because that was the narrative through December and January, and Pete Hegseth, the self-styled Secretary of War, is announcing we're going to rain death down on the population of Tehran all day long, all night long. This is what he said, and this coincides with reports that the United States has already depleted a large portion of its precision munitions. So therefore, what it's left with is, well, what Trump is boasting is we have unlimited gravity bombs. So high altitude bombings, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 pound bombs hitting densely populated urban centers. The United States has not engaged in that type of scorched earth warfare since Operation Rolling Thunder under Lyndon Baines Johnson in Laos, Cambodia, and North Vietnam. Or we can look back at Dresden, or, you know, we could talk about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But there's whole conventions and institutions and agreements that have been put in place since those days, since the leveling of Pyongyang in the Korean War, that all designed to prevent this type of total warfare. So what I see is the United States and Israel is turning back the clock on this. So we are not, you know, as a Western society or civilization, we are not developing or evolving forward on this. I see this as a retrograde move by the U.S. And it's I don't really know. It defies analysis right now, because the reason it defies analysis, Kyle, is because, you know, when they war gamed out a war with Iran, the Pentagon has done this multiple times. The RAND Corporation, these types of institutions will do that, and it has always come out very bad for the United States. At some point during, we've seen these reports and read these analysis, but the inputs and the variables in those war gaming scenarios did not factor in that there would be total disregard for civilian deaths, that targeting densely populated areas. And that is a new normal in 2026 warfare following Israel's genocide in Gaza. And so if the United States continue on that through line of Israeli tactics of killing your way to victory, then that basically confounds all of those wargaming exercises that we can look back at. Sure, they make sense logically, but that's under, you know, that's predicated on this assumption that the United States will not be targeting every single potential political office holder, which is what Israel does, and this is what they have up at Joint Command. They have the names, the faces, the equivalent of the deck of cards, and every sort of asset is focused at assassinating whoever is next in line in the government or in the IRGC in this case. This is what they did with Hamas, Hezbollah, and all these other, and Syria, and all these countries that defied or challenged Israel. So if that's, so, you know, what are we going to be left with there? What about the use of nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons? That's being kicked around right now in certain circles and talked about with a level of normality that's quite disturbing. So that means we can't really rely on those old, analyses and these wargaming scenarios with Iran. So it's, you know, Iran has a major advantage in that they're playing on their home field and they're defending themselves, and they have a substantial missile arsenal and drone arsenal. And I saw some of it when I was there, and including spoke to a high-ranking officer in the missile program about some of that. But they will, they're going to, and have already incurred heavy, substantial losses. The United States has incurred unprecedented losses in terms of all these different bases that have been hit, downed aircraft, downed drones, potential naval losses coming down the pipeline. But Iran as well has substantial losses. Israel has incurred substantial losses. The question is, what will Israel and the U.S. do if things aren't looking good? And if you look at the Hebrew language speeches by Netanyahu, is no longer doing bilingual. He's sending separate messages in Hebrew and broadcast, and separate in English. And if you look at the translations of some of the recent ones, I think it was one about 5 days ago when this just was beginning, that if things go south for us, that we will unleash a surprise that will shock the world. So what is he inferring to there? But that was in the Hebrew language. Is that a veiled threat that Israel might deploy a nuclear weapon? I don't know, but certainly that's something you'd want to have, you know, a major hearing on in Washington, because that is world changing. And Yep. Do we see any, there's no concern for any of this at the moment in Washington. After the congressional vote, Kyle, or the Senate vote, the GOP lawmakers are saying online this is a victory for America. This is somehow a victory for America, that we didn't allow these peaceniks to stop this glorious campaign by the Trump administration. I mean, this is where we're at right now politically.
Absolutely. And I definitely share your concerns about the use of a nuclear weapon. I think we've moved away from norms. And also, over the past, 2.5 years, we've heard this constant refrain from American and Israeli politicians, which is, you know, Israel could do to Gaza what the Americans did in World War II. And that did include dropping a nuclear weapon. And so I don't think they would use that against Gaza, but against Iran, it does seem to me to be possible. Patrick, thank you so much for your time today on today's show and helping us break all this down. I mean, these events are unfolding rapidly. Producer Chris has texted me during the show that there's a lot of Iranian missiles getting through Israel. Tel Aviv is getting hit a few times. The Ben-Gurion airport has been struck. So there's a lot happening all the time. Even when you try to sit down to do one of these interviews, you got to catch up on the half hour of news that you missed. So a lot unfolding in the world, and you're insight and expertise is really important, especially since you were just in Iran. The country we're with is really fundamental. So everybody, be sure to check out all of Patrick's work, 21st Century Wire. He's a regular with Danny Davis over on The Deep Dive. I love that show, and it's always great to see Patrick on once, usually every week or two, I think. So Patrick, hopefully we could do this again soon.
Yep. Thank you very much, Kyle.
Thank you.